Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
The Bob Seska Show.
Bob Seska.
Today's Rachel Maddow Show Award for Headline Excellence goes to Bob Seska.
The Bob Seska Show.
From our nation's capital, it is Wednesday, September 28, 2022, and this is the Bob Seska Interview on the Sexy Liberal Podcast Network. Hi, I'm Bob.
Hello, Bob.
Hi, day 617 of the Biden-Harris administration, 40 days until the 22 midterms. Find me on Instagram at TheBobSeska, Twitter, BobSeska_go, and our Patreon page is BobSeskaShow.com. So today we're talking about the first on-screen political smear campaign in American history with author-director Greg Mitchell, who returns for his third appearance on the podcast. Greg's the writer-director of the brand-new PBS documentary, The First Attack Ads, Hollywood versus Upton Sinclair. It documents the 1934 gubernatorial campaign in California in which big money interests and Hollywood executives teamed up to totally derail Upton Sinclair's campaign. Lots of very familiar smear tactics were rolled out for the first time in this one, and we're going to talk with Greg about how it all played out. You can catch the documentary on PBS starting October 1. Plus, you can watch at kcet.org/firstattackads. Links in the description for everything, of course. Meantime, please help support this show by subscribing to our bonus content at bobseskashow.com. Okay, here's me and Greg talking about the first attack ads.
More fun, more music, the Bob Seska Show.
There he is, Greg Mitchell. Holy shit. How are you, man?
I'm very good. I hope you can't use holy shit on the air, though, or on the podcast, right?
Oh, I so totally can.
Oh, you can? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. This ain't radio, Greg. Okay. I can say whatever the hell I want.
I've been long associated with that language.
All right. Well, holy hell, man. You've been busy, 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 busy. Thanks for taking the time to be here today.
Sure. Happy to do it.
Before we get into Upton Sinclair and everything like that, how's the newsletter going? It's one of my favorite things, checking my email inbox every day. Yeah.
You know, it's good. I get good feedback. I don't get as many subscribers, even though it's free. I don't get as many subscribers as I would like to or think I would, you know. I did get into it a little later after the big surge in newsletters, where after, you know, people were starting to get 8 or 10 or 28 in their box, and maybe that has something to do with it. I'm always a little bit of a letdown in terms of not as many subscribing as I would like.
Yeah, it's a real challenge sometimes to build up those things. I find it's just a process. It's just a long, long process of attrition, just beating people to death with it until they join up, right?
Something new will be invented by then, and then they'll have to,
Well, how can people sign up for your newsletter? Let's get that out of the way first.
Well, I guess they'd have to find it. I guess if they search Greg Mitchell Substack, they'd find it. I mean, it's called Music and Politics.
Oh, there you go.
Or Between Rock and a Hard Place.
All right.
So.
Sounds good. Yeah.
I guess that would do it.
It's got politics in there. You do political cartoons occasionally, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Music, a lot of music videos, my own memoirs of my days at Crawdaddy. So
yeah, let's get some more people signed up for your newsletter. I think it's about damn time.
It's about time. That's right.
Get that fixed. So I love the new documentary about this smear campaign, this historic smear campaign against Upton Sinclair in California. It's so incredibly germane to our current politics, Greg. And of course, you know that. But before we talk about what happened to Sinclair in 1934, tell us about some of the political smear campaigns that preceded 34, being the first big on-screen campaign. Obviously, there was a long history leading up to that, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, dirty politics has been a part of American history and campaigns, you know, forever. You know, some of the people we feel are so were so revered and elevated back in the day, like, you know, Washington and Jefferson and Abraham Lincoln, for gosh sake, all were victims of, you know, personal attacks and, you know, the worst sorts of language. And then you had campaigns back then. And this is, you know, this is very important to remember when we get to 1934, is that campaigns were always run by the parties themselves. And you've probably heard the expression ward healers, who are the sort of the local big city people who are in charge of various local areas, but all under the thumb and direction of the party boss. Of course, Boss Tweed was an important figure, Tammany Hall in New York City, and so forth. So whatever abuses there were, and fixed elections, and forced donations, you know, came out of the party structure. And that started to change, you know, thanks to this 1934 campaign that we'll be talking about.
Well, a couple of the more notorious ones before 34, wasn't it the election of 1800 between Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, where I think they got, I think Jefferson got John Callender involved in that. He was a newspaper publisher, and just some horrendous smear campaigns against John Adams. Of course, John Adams wasn't innocent in that regard either. And then, you know, you maybe fast forward to 1860, that particular election, which was one of the most heinous that we had ever seen up to that point, because they just, the fire eaters in the South especially, just let fly with the most racist attacks against Abraham Lincoln and what he was seeking to do in his campaign. And that was completely detached from reality. I think that's the common notion behind all of these smear campaigns, is that it's purely disinformation. I mean, there's barely any substance to it that bears out in fact, right?
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, that's the name of the game, I guess. And of course, back in those days, there was always a strong visual element already with cartoons. Newspaper cartoons and cartoons that were printed on leaflets. Again, you had the parties that would print up pamphlets and distribute, you know, campaign flyers with really vicious cartoons. And there's one, of course, when I was back in school, I think the campaign that got the most attention in this regard was the Grover Cleveland campaign.
Mama, where's my pa, right?
Yeah, where he was accused, and perhaps rightly, I'm not sure what the final judgment of history is, of, you know, fathering an illegitimate child. You know, that always got a lot of attention in school, I remember. And of course, that was in my film. I've got a cartoon from that, which is very funny and so forth. So, you know, so there always was a visual element to this sort of thing. They didn't, of course, didn't use the movie screen or the TV screen. You know, which again is the innovations we get to in 1934.
So leading up to 34, for the uninitiated, Greg, tell us a little bit about Upton Sinclair's career up to that point, up to the point where he decided to run for governor of California. So he had been publishing these very popular muckraking books, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, again, but going back to school days, he was always included with the muckrakers, you know, Lincoln, Stephens and so forth. And I guess I was a little, when I started getting back into him about 40 years ago, I was surprised even that his, of course, his most famous book, The Jungle, about the meatpacking horrid conditions in Chicago, was actually a novel. I guess I would have always figured it was, you know, a nonfiction book. But indeed, most of his work was as a novelist. He took social issue things that were in the public mind and muckraked, as you might say, but turned them into novels, often very successfully, sometimes less so. But at the same time, he was a kind of a pamphleteer, you might say, a polemicist, public speaker. He was, in his day, one of the world's most famous socialists. He was a member of the Socialist Party.
Yep.
He was very much associated with the socialism, which was kind of booming at the time. And he was very famous around the world. His books were translated and published around the world. And he was really, really one of the most popular, famous Americans in his day, even as his books kind of varied in quality and sales. But he did. I mean, he wrote a classic two-part novel on Sacco and Vanzetti, for example. He wrote a book on oil in California, which became the Daniel Day-Lewis movie.
Oh, There Will Be Blood.
Became many years later. You could take any social issue, and he probably wrote a book, a novel or a nonfiction book about it. He would be arrested. And he started running for office in California as a socialist. He ran for governor twice and got very few votes.
So he had run previous to 34.
He had run, yes, okay. as a socialist and got about 50,000 votes.
Right.
So we got to 1933, and of course, FDR had been elected. Mm-hmm. The Democrats were on the rise. There'd never been a Democratic governor in California. California was booming during the Depression with all the people moving in from the Midwest. It actually had been booming before that in the 1920s, and then more people came. So California was kind of booming, but it had always been Republican business going back. Going back forever. Mm-hmm. So Upton Sinclair, and of course there was great poverty in the state with all the people moving in and so forth. So
yeah, and that was actually going to be later used against him, right? It was going to be used as a platform to smear Upton Sinclair as dragging in all these people who are seeking jobs during the Depression, and that would be used as a cudgel to attack Upton Sinclair. It's incredible. Right. The prosperity in California was actually then used against Sinclair in the smear campaign we're about to talk about, for sure. So go ahead.
No, so I was just going to say, so in 1933, he decided he would write a, because he was a writer, he decided, well, maybe I should run as a Democrat, which he never had done. And, I'll write a book about it, which of course is very common today. Candidates run for president or even the Senate, and they always write a book. In advance. And sometimes it's just a, crappy memoir of some kind. But I guess maybe Sinclair invented this too. I'm not sure. But he wrote a book, which is actually more of a booklet. It was about 60, 70 pages long.
Yeah.
And it was called I, Governor of California and How I Ended Poverty.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a fanciful look back at how a candidate Upton Sinclair ran for governor and on an end poverty platform and inspired a mass movement somehow and somehow was elected governor and then had this wonderful 4-year term or whatever. And he published it in 1933, and then he changed his party affiliation to Democrat and set out to make the story true. My new film, which airs on PBS, really looks at what happened later when we really more later at the near the end of the campaign when he was the subject of the all these smears and the first attack ads.
Yep,
the title of the film. Thanks to MGM and so forth, but so there isn't as much play in the film about the actual epic, the end poverty in California movement and and the early days of that movement. Now, that's all in my book. I will plug my book, which is called The Campaign of the Century, which is, I have to say, something of a classic in the field. It was picked by the Wall Street Journal, for example, as one of the five best books ever written about any American election.
Wow, outstanding.
I won a major award, and et cetera, et cetera. So that book is 600 pages long and includes everything.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyone, if you're interested in the subject, then of course I want you to see the film. But the book itself goes into the full story, and it's incredibly lively. It was the craziest, wackiest campaign you can imagine. every famous figure at the time, from Ezra Pound and Will Rogers to Katharine Hepburn and Charlie Chaplin, was involved in the campaign. And so there's all kinds of incredible, often funny quotes and wild charges and incredible, colorful personalities. So, so I will plug the book for that. But in any case, the Sinclair campaign caught fire. He did indeed inspire one of the greatest mass movements in our history. Hundreds of epic chapters were founded all over the state. They started a weekly newspaper that ended up with over a million circulation every week, which is just astounding. Tens of thousands of people registered to vote. And this mass movement carried him along, so that the following August, 1934, against a very credible group of Democratic opponents, Sinclair swept the primary in a landslide and appeared to be on the verge of being elected governor and making his book come true.
So why was the establishment in California, the moneyed establishment, so terrified of Upton Sinclair? Why did they see Upton Sinclair as such a threat to their power structure?
Well, maybe because he was.
There you go.
Perfect. He's leading a populist mass movement. He's laid out his platform, which, called for, it's hard to boil down, in a couple minutes, but it called for some things that actually FDR would end up adopting and being famous for, a real social security system and, jobs programs and so on and so forth. But it also went further than that. In setting up a system where it was called production for use, and it would basically say, we have all this great manpower in the state and woman power, and we've got all these great resources in California, and there's so much food and oranges and everything else. Surely we can put people to work, creating, making things, and selling things almost, you don't want to call it a commune or a socialistic kind of utopia, but basically people would work and then sell to others in the state who needed food or needed work done, build houses or whatever. And it was almost like a barter situation, but it was, it was kind of socialistic, you might say, on a state scale, in that you would provide jobs and work for all these people who would be paid in money or in goods, and so many people would benefit from it. And it was just his claim, which was actually true, was that California was actually a very rich state. It just needed to have people working the fields and working factories and doing all that. So this was a threat to the powers that be. California had been run by the oil companies and by the banks and even by the Automobile Association, the usual vested interests. And so they took this as a as an incredible threat to them. And we can get to Hollywood in a couple minutes if you want.
But sure.
Hollywood was certainly in the forefront of that, with the movie moguls who were then quite conservative may surprise many listeners. Think of liberal Hollywood, but almost all the movie moguls then were quite conservative and Republican. And they went so far as to threaten to move to Florida if Sinclair was elected.
That's right.
And I make the joke that, well, there always was already was a city named Hollywood in Florida, so they just moved there.
Exactly right. So how did this smear campaign launch? Who were the architects of this thing? Who started the idea of turning to film and the shorts that were shown before movies at the time as a platform for a smear campaign?
Well, you know, the not just in terms of movies, but in terms of so much else in California, you know, William Randolph Hearst was a key player. He owned, of course, the great newspaper chain and also made movies at a movie studio. So he was in the forefront. Certainly the California press, the LA Times was incredibly vicious towards Sinclair. Almost every daily newspaper in the entire state was against Sinclair. But, you know, Hearst was also involved in certainly politics and in Hollywood. And then the other major player there was Louis B. Mayer, the head of MGM, who was also, I think, second in command of the state Republican Party, a longtime Republican activist. And so he was kind of the prime mover in Hollywood. And they recognize, you know, as I show in my book, not so much in the film, because the film has to kind of jump right into the action, but you know, it took a little time to build, but all these intersections of Hollywood and, you know, the head of the Sunkist Growers, you can imagine what kind of force they were.
Right.
A.P. Giannini, the founder of the Bank of America, again, the most famous California bank. I mean, if you name it, whoever was what any big name in California was involved in this campaign, you know, almost all of them against Sinclair. So, but, you know, the Hollywood angle basically came about. They tried all sorts of things to turn the election around. That the candidate was actually an incumbent named Frank Miriam, a Republican.
Yep.
Who was, you know, was an incredible hack, dullard ox, as Westbrook Pegler called him.
Right.
Not, you know, not an inspiring character, but, you know, a Republican incumbent. So they, at least they had that going for them. And so the basically Hollywood tried all sorts of things. I mentioned the move, threatening to move to Florida. They even took it, a couple of people took a trip there, a well-publicized trip to scout locations. another thing they did was they forced at almost every studio, they forced all the staffers from you know, wardrobe people to top stars to donate one day's pay to the Republican campaign or the slush fund. You know, very few were in the position to refuse. Jimmy Cagney was one. There's some conflicting evidence on Katharine Hepburn. I interviewed Billy Wilder before he died. Billy Wilder, director, had just arrived in America, and he fought it and fought it, but finally gave in. So
Chaplin was a supporter of Sinclair.
Yeah, Chaplin Chaplin was one of it was a longtime friend of Sinclair, so he supported Sinclair.
Right.
But I don't think he gave him any money, but that was Charlie.
Here's the best way to listen to the Bob Seska Show without all of these commercial interruptions. Just go right now to our Patreon page at BobSeskaShow.com. Scroll down to the link for the ultimate edition of the podcast and sign up for just $15 per month. In exchange for your super generous support, we're going to give you a completely commercial-free version of the Tuesday show, the Wednesday show, and the Thursday show. Plus, you're going to get the Shadow Docket show every Tuesday and Thursday. And wait, more things. You're also going to get the After Party podcast on Fridays with me and Kimberly included in that level of support, all for just $15 per month. Again, you get everything we have to offer at BobSeskaShow.com, and we thank you.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Bob Seska!
All-time favorites all day long!
Hollywood, I guess the darker side of Hollywood, I should say, has been sort of a through line in some of your more recent work. What is it about the darker side of Hollywood that attracts you to it as a, as a subject? I'm fascinated by this because we're kind of on the same page about that. I'm very weary of this notion of quote-unquote liberal Hollywood. I think there are some people, yes, actors and some of the creative people are liberal, but by and large, you've got an entire community of executives there who are as far right and capitalist as can be,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Well, of course, I've had two or three books, and I think two of my films recently have Hollywood's kind of been the bad guy.
Yeah.
But you know, these are historical things going back to before the 1950s. So, you know, I'll leave you to take care of the modern day.
thank you. You know,
back then it really was, and it really was true that Hollywood was not to the left. And in fact, jumping a little ahead in our story, the Sinclair campaign was a big reason that Hollywood did start to move to the left, because the outrages by the studios so angered the screen actors and screenwriters who had just started their guilds,
yep,
and were having trouble getting traction. The outrage over this 1934 campaign sparked a huge surge in the screenwriters and the Screen Actors Guild. Mm-hmm. And so they got, you know, many, many more members and turned very much to the left. And then it took a while for the moguls and the producers and directors to catch up. But
yeah,
the real seeds of the liberal Hollywood was formed in reaction to this race. So,
And so much of what we see of Hollywood, even at that period of time when the filmmaking industry was still very much in its infancy, is all fantasy. It's a facade. What we see of Hollywood is a show, and there's a lot of seedy, dark things that occur under there. And I'm so glad that you're sort of on the wall, Greg, pointing out some of that history.
Well, you know, I guess it's like the Hollywood sets, right? It's false facades, right?
Exactly, right.
It's always funny to see what's behind them, but and sometimes not so funny. But
no,
you know,
not.
You know, going back to the 34 race, again, speeding up a little bit here, is that, you know, and the notion of the first attack ads. Basically what happened when we got into October of that year, Sinclair was probably still seen as winning.
Mm-hmm.
And so the next step was taken, which I'm sure some in our audience, and maybe many, I'm not sure, have seen the movie Mank, the David Fincher movie.
Oh,
and
yes.
This next part here was in a very important subplot in that movie, which is, and the movie was, even though it did have plenty of things false, it did capture a lot of the essence of this, which is that Irving Thalberg at MGM, he was known as the boy wonder, married to Norma Shearer, was certainly the most famous and popular producer in all of Hollywood. Really second in command to Louis B. Mayer at MGM. Not particularly political himself. In fact, he had been a boyhood orator for the socialists in New York City. But, you know, he didn't really care about politics much one way or the other. And he, you know, he joined in and, well, Upton Sinclair's definitely has to be defeated, even though he had not long before purchased two movie ideas and books from Upton Sinclair and paid him a very large sum of money to make into movies. So that's how there's Hollywood in your nutshell.
Yes, there. The contradictions are immense.
Right. So, but in any case, Thalberg decided to make a series of three movie shorts. Sometimes they've been sort of inaccurately, including by myself, referred to as newsreels. They actually were movie shorts. And, you know, some of you may know that at back in the day, even back maybe in my day, movie shorts were shown before most movies in theaters. Mm-hmm. Little comedy things. Of course, there was Laurel and Hardy and Chaplin and Harold Lloyd and wacky little Three Stooges, et cetera. And then, of course, cartoons.
Were shown
before movies. And, of course, movies were incredibly popular. It's like watching TV. I guess it was like watching primetime TV before everyone started streaming.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I don't want to make the comparison to today's TV. But back then, so many people went to the movies every week, you know, or more months a week.
And a lot of people got their news from the newsreels.
Right, newsreels. There were news, very popular news. You know, yep. Hearst and everyone else, they had all these newsreels. And so, and I guess you could smoke and the whole thing. So what more could you want? So you had an enormous audience there and an audience that was used to taking serious when there was serious news presented in newsreels or in movie shorts, were used to taking it seriously and not thinking they were, you know, they're being bamboozled.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So you have a captive audience and you have an audience that's, you know, sort of suspends belief or disbelief, which I guess is what Hollywood's all about. Mm-hmm. So Thalberg had the genius idea of making these three movie shorts. And, you know, in my first Attack Ads film, this is kind of what I focus on. And but what he did was he took a maker of shorts and little screen tests for MGM named Felix Feist Jr. and sent him out with a crew to interview. The first two of these movie shorts were basically inquiring reporter things.
Yes.
Where you go out in the street and pigeonhole various people, not exactly a scientific sample, even in the best of circumstances, and ask them awkwardly, you know, what do you think about this or that? And so, so that's what they did here. And they did, you know, they did interview, you know, some people who were actually, you know, people in the street in Southern California, of course. Mm-hmm. But they also interviewed or set up a few people from Central Casting who were kind of given scripts.
Of course.
And so they were filmed, of course, they were either blasting Upton Sinclair or endorsing Miriam, his opponent. And they were, so if you watched these two newsreels, you would see all the very reputable people, well-dressed, well-spoken.
Yep.
So nice old grandmothers, small businessmen, all endorsing Miriam and raising alarms about Upton Sinclair, calling him a radical and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'd have the Sinclair people.
Yes.
who were tended to be a little shady looking,
odd looking, odd sounding.
Spoke with foreign accents. Mm-hmm. Two of them called him Upton St. Clair. one of them actually said, I would vote for Upton St. Clair. He was the author of The Russian Government. Ah! And it worked very well there, and it will work well here.
Wow, yes. And then there was another guy who's like, I support Upton Sinclair, but some of his policies are a little too radical for me. Right. And this is like, oh, okay, all right, we see what's going on here. Yeah. And you know,
so some of these people were actually real people. Okay, they could cherry pick. They had enough people to cherry pick. And if they see a gap-toothed old guy shuffling on the street, and they'd say, oh, let's interview that guy. And then, of course, he endorses Sinclair.
Right.
But some of them were also obviously straight from central casting and were given scripts and so forth. So so these two movie shorts, of course, caused a sensation. Where you got a lot of press. They're supposedly were showing the public opinion and the direction of the campaign. So even people who didn't see them could be influenced by them.
Yeah.
And the other thing Hollywood did was they basically made a deal so that instead of just being shown before certain studios movies, all of the theater owners opened up their screens for these. So they were shown, in almost every theater, as opposed to just, certain ones.
Before we go off of the Man on the Street shorts, but before we leave that subject, I want to talk about that because there's something that's nefarious about the psychology that's employed with these sorts of things. It actually reinforces the biases of the people watching that in a sort of toxic feedback loop, making it okay to believe stupid shit. It's like when Chuck Todd reports on poll results on cable news. For example, is climate change real? We're going to talk about what people think about climate change. Instead of reporting on the truth of the issue, they're just reflecting the bias of the people. And the awful thing about that is it works. It's completely wrong, but it works. And we see it on display right here with these early shorts.
Yeah. Well, what's key about this is that there hadn't been anything like this before. Mm-hmm. There had been dirty campaigns, as we mentioned.
Yeah.
But the moving pictures, newsreels, movie screen, either stayed out of politics or it was just very, they would try to run it down the middle, or they certainly didn't have commercials or things that were that one-sided. So people didn't really expect that this was, kind of faked. So it had an especially big impact.
It sounds an awful lot like Fox News Channel, what Roger Ailes did in 1998, where he started mixing in propaganda and disinformation and disguising it as actual news. So you mix in these, in particular, these three shorts against Upton Sinclair, and you put them up right next to newsreels and things like that to make them seem more legitimate, right? And that's exactly what Roger Ailes did with Fox News Channel. Everything that's old is new again, right?
Yeah. So what then happened was, of course, Sinclair hadn't yet been knocked out of the race. So Thalberg then sent Felix Feist out to basically Colton, California, which was a terminus for the Southern Pacific Railroad. Mm-hmm. And now they may have tried, maybe they even succeeded slightly in finding. They wanted what was the biggest issue in the press. And again, this is the way the press and the Hollywood and the media sort of joined forces. Is the big story in the press at the time was this influx of alleged bums and hobos and migrants. Here we have a subject very
torn from the headlines.
Here comes the migrants are heading to California, and so they wanted to go out and film some of them coming in on boxcars and trains and so forth. And And this was, and they supposedly they were coming because they were promised work by Upton Sinclair and his epic Utopia and so forth. So now there's this incredible, allegedly this incredible rush to California, thanks to Upton Sinclair.
Yeah.
So MGM hoped to, I don't know if they hoped to, maybe they thought they could find some hobos coming in, and they may have, maybe they even did film a little, you know, a small number, but
they use clips. They use clips from actual movies.
Supplement whatever they got, and it's impossible to tell exactly what they filmed, but it's kind of clear what they didn't film, because, you know, I found the footage that had been shot earlier and basically was already in archives, and of bums coming in, you know, jumping off trains somewhere. and even clips, outtakes from a recent movie, movie drama was used. And so they kind of, you know, MGM, of course, is very creative and professional studio, so they are able to kind of mix these kind of clips together with the narration, all aimed at explicitly warning about these people coming in, and they're coming in to take your job, and they're bums, and they're you know, they don't care about you, and they're all, ever since they heard about the Epic plan, they're heading for California, right? And so this became the movie short number three in the last week of the campaign, and it really caused a sensation because the Sinclair supporters in the audience, of which there were many, some of them told me they kind of laughed about the inquiring reporter thought it was, no one could believe that stuff, but this one they saw accurately. I mean, this maybe you might say was the first modern attack ad, because it really was showing allegedly true things that were going on, and so this caused riots in movie theaters.
Wow!
And Sinclair people, one of whom I interviewed, you know, were just yelling and shouting, and it's yelling out, it's propaganda, you know. And storming the box office and all that kind of stuff. So this third one really set off a lot of outrage.
Right.
But again, I'm sure it was very, very effective throughout, you know, running throughout the straight a week before the campaign.
And there was an element too where they were attacking Sinclair, and this is something that's also very familiar in modern times. They were attacking socialist Sinclair as being a communist. I mean, they were going full blown communist with some of those smears, right?
Yeah. Well, he was actually very anti-communist. There was even a communist candidate in the campaign. The socialists then were very anti-communist.
Yeah.
And so now, of course, people lump socialism with communism then. So it was very easy, very easy to do. So, red baiting was a big thing. All these, the leaflets, you know, as I mentioned, what was the big, the other big innovation of the campaign was the Sinclair threat was so great that the Republicans, the conservative Democrats, went outside the party apparatus for the first time.
Yes.
And they put in charge of the campaign advertising people, public relations people, some from national, from Chicago and New York City. And what now we would call political consultants, the first two political consultants in U.S. history, Clem Whitaker and Leona Baxter.
They were out of San Francisco, right?
Yeah. They were hired to basically set up front groups and run the campaign in the North. There was an incredible slush fund that paid for zillions of pamphlets and leaflets and distributed all over the state, you know, with the wildest accusations against Sinclair. And so some of them weren't even that wild, that they just went everywhere. And so you had what basically the first time a campaign was really run by spin doctors, political consultants, advertising people, a national fundraising for a state race. And that's why I called my book The Campaign of the Century, because sure, it wasn't the most important campaign of the century. But in terms of changing politics, changing how elections were run, it was my claim. This was the campaign of the century. So, and then you mix in how this was Hollywood's first all-out plunge into politics. So all those elements came together in this one race. And basically because, you know, what a socialist was about to be elected governor of one of the largest states in the land.
Okay, short break. Back with more Greg Mitchell right after this.
More fun, more music, the Bob Seska Show.
And so the shorts didn't contain any credits or attributions. So audiences generally had no idea who the hell was behind these films. What effect did that have? Obviously, we see parallels now with dark money groups and so on. So this was a similar thing, but in terms of the actual content. So what was the effect of the lack of attribution?
Well, it may have helped them, I suppose, or people would say this is not MGM, for example, coming from them. Or, well, we know that the studios are, you know, Republican. And so I'm not so sure that was the aim. I just think MGM didn't want to be associated with it. Or, but yeah, it was very unusual at the time to have no credits at the beginning or the end. It just California election news with a map of California. And then straight into the 4 or 5 minute short.
What was the White House's involvement, if at all? I know Roosevelt didn't endorse the Uppy and Downey ticket, as it became known. Right. And so why was that? Well, you would think that Roosevelt might be all over a campaign like Upton Sinclair's, given what Roosevelt would eventually go on to do as his solution to the Depression.
Yeah, you know, as I show in the book and the film, the I mean, you could write a whole book about FDR and this campaign. So complicated. I mean, one of the first things Sinclair did after he won the primary in August was make the long trip to Hyde Park in New York to visit with Roosevelt at home. And of course, he assumed that Roosevelt either would endorse him then or at some point. I mean, he's the standard bearer for the party in California.
Yeah.
California's never had a Democratic governor.
Mm-hmm.
There's another election coming up in a couple of years and FDR would want to carry California. And he thought FDR's heart was in the right place and so forth. So he made this long trip and they were very friendly. And he came out of the meeting kind of hinting that Roosevelt would endorse him at some point. And Roosevelt indeed may have told him that. I'm not sure, we can't say for sure. But then as the weeks went on, I think FDR got cold feet. Some of his advisors wanted him to endorse Sinclair, others didn't. They thought it might tarnish what FDR was trying to do, which was, there was no slam dunk. You know, most of the major New Deal legislation hadn't passed yet. You know, some of it had. And then, of course, because of the effects of this smear campaign, made Roosevelt start to fear that, well, Sinclair is not going to win anyway. So the last thing I want to do is endorse him.
Yeah.
So the smear campaign, it wasn't directed at keeping FDR out of the race, but it was a nice byproduct.
Mm-hmm.
And so FDR then did not endorse Sinclair. And so, well, I guess he's neutral. But it actually, as I showed for the first time behind the scenes, near the end of the campaign, White House operatives actually did cut a deal with Sinclair's opponent where they would kind of signal that they didn't really like Sinclair. Ugh. And in return, the Republican opponent would not oppose the New Deal once he took office. So in the end, FDR kind of not a profile in courage. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, now we look back at FDR and we think, OK, well, here's a man of principles who was kind of like a juggernaut moving forward, especially in the 1930s. And
it wasn't necessarily that way. I mean, obviously, he got a lot of amazing things done, lots of legacy things. But at the same time, there were a couple of instances, and this being one of them, in which FDR walked right up to the line and then backed off. I would say another example of that was in 37, when he cut back on a lot of the New Deal spending, which created another recession. And so it wasn't all like full speed ahead for FDR throughout those years, was it?
Yeah. Well, he had, I mean, you know, let's say he was not a flaming radical to begin with, but he couldn't get, he had a better, if you want to compare him to Biden or Obama, he had a little more, he had a little more personal popularity and he had a little more of an edge in Congress, but it was not a slam dunk. Mm-hmm. And so he was always concerned, okay, I've got this, legislation through, but am I going to be able to get this through? And if I'm being tagged as a socialist and so forth, then, it's not going to happen. Cause there was plenty of opposition to FDR, even among Democrats, and he had to, he had to squeeze things through. So, he certainly could have behaved differently here. He could have behaved differently in some other cases. That's what we sort of say about Obama. You know, he was a little too right. I mean, he got some good things done. He pushed at some times, but in general was very squishy and, didn't push hard enough for certain things. And, and that happened with Roosevelt too. But, after 1934, when there was, even though Sinclair lost, a lot of other liberal or lefty type candidates won.
Yeah, there was a
even
real.
In California itself, except Sinclair didn't win, but a lot of other state candidates did win. California never looked back. It's been towards the liberal edge, at least on the Democratic side, ever since. And so Roosevelt was able to get more done in 1935 and 1936 before, as you say, he started pulling back again.
Right. And there were so many, as you just said, there's so many upsides to that 34 election, with you had a lot of down ballot liberals winning their races during that same election. What were some of the other upsides? You also mentioned, I think, the unionization of Hollywood, for example.
Yeah.
And so that started the ball rolling. And it's so ironic that Sinclair didn't win, but yet all of these other positive developments emerged out of that.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it was, 1935, 36, 37 was the real surge in union organizing across the country. Mm-hmm. And you had some wild men in other places. Huey Long, for all his faults, was certainly a voice of many people in Louisiana. And there were other sort of lefty types around the country, La Follette's and so forth. So it was, it was an exciting time and a lot of progress was made. A lot of things became established, including labor unions. And again, all the battles they had and some of the battles they lost and all that, but yet labor unions became entrenched and of course flourished into the 50s and 60s. So, I mean, thank God for that. And thank God they're coming back now. But, there's a lot of great progress that came out of the 30s, even though some of it was turned back, many years later.
If it hadn't been for the smear campaign, do you think Sinclair would have won? I know it's kind of a what if hypothetical, but you think he would have won that race?
I think he very well might have, because there was such, such support for him and excitement, and the first 3 weeks after the election, 4 weeks after the primary, the Democratic infrastructure, all the leaders in California endorsed him, and they came. They had a big party convention, and they posed with him and said good things about him. Because at that point, the real smear campaign had not begun yet, and the thought was, okay, he can win. We're going to have to deal with it. And then, like every radical, when he takes office, he's going to move to the middle.
Yeah.
So let's bring him into the fold here. And, there's no question that, let's say 6 weeks before the election in November, he was definitely the front runner.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact,
and it was only after the smear campaign that, and the movie shorts and everything else, that the Democrats started drifting from him. And once the Democratic leaders started drifting, it was a signal to the non-epic type people that they should maybe stay home or mm-hmm. or vote for the Republican.
And of course, operatives like Rove, Atwater, Stone, Bannon, all descendants of the 34 crusade against Sinclair, right? Or do you see that as the launching off point for modern smear campaigns that we see today? Or do you trace it all the way back to, you know, the founding of the Republic? You trace it all the way back to 1800. What's the sort of patient zero for the ugly politics that we see so prevalent now?
Well, you know, as we said at the beginning, the certainly smear campaigns go back forever. But
sure.
The significance of the 34 race was the bringing to the fore the freelance experts from outside the parties.
There it is.
Who were much better at what they did. Mm-hmm. And so not only were they much better at what they did in public relations and advertising, but the new use of the movie screen. And that, which of course became television, 15 years later or so. So I think you can trace the, that's why I say, I say this is the birth of the modern political campaign.
Yeah.
So much came out of this campaign. And so, and of course now you have attack ads that are central to campaigns, sure. Not just kind of like, even back in the days of the Willie Horton ad, for example.
Oh, yeah.
It was like, well, this is sort of a crazy, interesting thing, and it seems to be having a big impact, you know, but it was in a presidential race, and it was part of a much, much bigger strategy, where it seems like in this year, for example, attack ads are almost central to most campaigns.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, you can't overstate the importance of these kind of attacks coming to the screen and how they were embraced, how they were seen as effective, and then, have grown during the television age and now online and streaming and everything else. So, so that alone was significant, but also just the turning over campaigns to the real whizzes.
Yeah.
The real whizzes are, Arthur Schlesinger put it, that this campaign showed the way from the smoke-filled room to Madison Avenue.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And in fact, there was a quote that jumped off the screen for me in the documentary, Greg, and that is the quote from Irving Thalberg, which was, "Nothing is unfair in politics."
Yeah.
And boy, do we see that writ large now. Donald Trump being primary example of that, the unfairness in politics. And so that's certainly been exploited these days. And yeah, you can definitely trace it all the way back to 34 for sure.
Yep. So anyway, so it's like it's easy to make these connections, I think. And it makes this, campaign, which is, I think, so interesting. I mean, I've been writing about this campaign for 40 years, literally. Mm-hmm. Of course, just recently was able to make the film. But it's always kept my interest because there's so many interesting characters involved and, both from the arts and from politics and writing and the press, people like Will Rogers became a true hero to me, so it's just an incredibly lively, in some ways crazy story, but with tremendous import, not just for the future of campaigns, but just when you get back to, okay, this was the time of the Depression. This was end poverty in California.
Yeah.
This was not a, like a Donald Trump, a mm-hmm. cult of personality or celebrity. Oh, Upton Sinclair, he's such a well-known person running this campaign. No, he was running on this platform to end poverty in California.
Yeah, yeah.
It could not be more serious, but at the same time, the circus around it was just incredibly colorful and, fun to watch, at least many years later.
I was mentioning What If earlier. Is that one of the attractions that you have to the 34 campaign and Upton Sinclair, the what if he had won, what would the trajectory of our history, our national history, in fact, been had he won that campaign? I mean, I think back to, you know, events like the assassination of JFK as another big what if. Like, what if he had not been assassinated and we had pulled out of Vietnam and that hadn't happened? And so it's one of the great what ifs for me. Is that one of the things that attracts you to that particular year and that particular campaign, or a combination of a bunch of different things?
Well, I suppose so, only because there was enough of that in the air there then, that in different states around the country, that, and in the arts, certainly, mm-hmm. And in the unions, factories, that you could see, well, if he had won and started to put his ideas into practice, and, maybe some of them he would have abandoned, and maybe some of them would have failed, but mm-hmm. maybe some of them would have succeeded. And you would have had, put not just the notion of, well, let's have unemployment relief, but let's have full employment. That would be, even if he came close to that, that would be a lesson for the rest of the country, you know, because the whole image was, you know, here's an able-bodied man or woman, able to work, wants to work. There's plenty of things to work on. Mm-hmm. There's plenty of things to produce and sell, or just build homes for other people, or provide food for other people. It's insane. You know, you step back from it and you say, well, it's insane that we don't have that even today. And so here it is. How many years later now? I've given up. 88.
Don't ask me to do the math, Greg. Huh?
I just did it pretty quickly there. So I'm a little older than you. I'm a little older than you. So, So I think if he succeeded even part way, it would have set an example.
Sure.
Even in losing, he helped push Roosevelt to the left. Mm-hmm. And we did get Social Security the next year and the Works Progress Administration and a bunch of other things. So imagine if he'd won. It's interesting to speculate because, the stakes were really high.
Are attack ads on television effective anymore? Seems like the real smear campaigns have migrated to the internet with just viral disinformation campaigns. We see lots of trolls and bots out of Russia and other places like that, injecting these kinds of ideas into the conversation more organically than some sort of presentational thing that you see during a commercial break, which most people are fast forwarding through on their DVRs anyway. So are we kind of seeing the last gasp of that as a format?
Well, I don't see that. I mean, it may be that they're not that effective, but certainly the candidates and their handlers think they are, because there's more of my observation are more than ever.
There's
more of them than ever. Hmm. And of course, you know, there's declining numbers for network TV, but where do these ads get the most play? Well, they're Twitter links and YouTube on YouTube. And if there was no internet, then you might say, well, you know, people aren't watching TV. They're reading books or something. I don't know. But instead people are on the web, and these ads are so easily spread, on social media that may even be the prime audience, social media. So you do a 30-minute or a 30-second or 60-second spot, and it's lively. One-sided and so forth. And then it gets spread everywhere. Mm-hmm. And that's maybe more in people's face than on TV commercials. They may turn away from commercials of any sort, whether it's Arby's or, politics. But, they're having a good time surfing the web and checking their Twitter and here's, these attack ads keep popping up, and some of them are kind of amusing. So, mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't see that I don't see that attack ads have peaked yet.
Okay. But, all right.
Who knows? There may be a revelation this year that, these are actually
hurting more than helping. And then we'll see. I don't know what we'll see after that. I don't know what the alternative is, but.
Well, meantime, the documentary is called The First Attack Ads, Hollywood versus Upton Sinclair. The premiere is, Saturday, October 1st, 9 p.m. on KCET in L.A.? Is that where the premiere is happening?
Yeah, but the key thing and what's exciting is that, the first two premieres are in Los Angeles, but it's going to be streaming right away. People are going to, if you any sort of PBS app, whether you have it yourself or it's on Apple TV, it's going to be out. It's going to be available nationally, and then it's going to roll out at stations around the country. Also, it's not like Ken Burns thing, where it's on the same night everywhere. But for example, it's going to be on WNET Channel 13 in New York City, which is the biggest station probably in the country, I would think.
Wow.
It's going to be on there on October, the night of October 9th, and then two more showings there. But, again, in the modern age, I imagine more people will see it via the web and, apps and so forth. So starting October 2nd, anyone who's interested, check your check online, check app. It may even be available right at the KCET in L.A., if you go to their site, go there and it'll be there. You won't even have to get a PBS app or look for it on Apple TV. It'll be there.
Right. KCET.org/firstattackads. That's the direct website address. And in fact, I'll put that in the description under this episode too, with all of the other appropriate links for how people can watch the documentary. It is utterly fascinating. It's about 30 minutes long. And it's as you were saying before, it's kind of a great companion piece to that movie Mank, which is an outstanding film. So, as you were saying, some historical inaccuracies in there, including what eventually became of Mr. Feist, which was not entirely
kill himself.
Right. Yeah.
Here's a spoiler alert. Okay. Feist did not kill himself.
And he didn't regret it. Yeah, he didn't regret the smear being part of the smear campaign. Greg, it was such a pleasure once again. Congratulations on this documentary. It's an amazing piece of work. I absolutely recommend it to everyone to check out, especially because it has such resonance today. And that's one of the many things that makes it so great. So thank you again for putting this together, you and Lynn Goldfarb, who was the producer on this project. And I'm looking forward to having you back on to talk about your next attack on Hollywood. Why do you hate Hollywood?
Well, actually, my next film is set close to the same period. And this time, Paramount is the bad guy.
Uh-oh. Can you preview exactly what that might be?
I'll let it go for that now. But it's another my fixation on how film footage is suppressed or distorted or can do bad things in the people powers that be that manipulate it. So that's my next. But Paramount becomes the kind of the bad guy in the next one.
Outstanding. Well, we'll have you back on as soon as that happens.
All right, Bob. Thanks. Always a pleasure.
Thanks so much, Greg. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Could we both be honest here this time? I won't spit your name if you'll learn mine. I'll be fine. Got this feeling love might have shown, but it's clear now I'll have to go. Where's all the angels in your name? Why can't I leave and be the same? I'll be fine. And it's clear now I'll have to go. There's just one thing I'd like to know now.
Bye.
There's just one thing I'd like to know. Couldn't we both left it alone? You and your world.
Find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.